and bestow the succession instead on her son Bharata. Underlying this plotline are several biological dramas that go back hundreds of millions of years in mammalian and avian evolution. All mammal and bird offspring depend on their parents in the first stage of life, seek parental care, and fear parental neglect or hostility. Life and death hang in the balance. A cub or chick pushed out of the nest too soon is in danger of death from starvation or predation. Among humans, the fear of being neglected or abandoned by one's parents is a template not just for children's stories like Snow White, Cinderella, and Harry Potter, but also for some of our most influential national and religious myths. The Ramayana is far from being the sole example. In Christian theology, damnation is conceived as losing all contact with the Mother Church and the Heavenly Father. Hell is a lost child crying for his or her missing parents. A related biological drama, which is also familiar to human children, mammalian cubs, and avian chicks, is "Father loves me more than he loves you." Biologists and geneticists have identified sibling rivalry as one of the key processes of evolution. Siblings routinely compete for food and parental attention, and in some species, the killing of one sibling by another is commonplace. About a quarter of spotted hyena cubs are killed by their siblings, who typically enjoy greater parental care as a result. Among sand tiger sharks, females hold numerous embryos in their uterus. The first embryo that reaches about 10 centimeters in length then eats all the others. The dynamics of sibling rivalry are manifested in numerous myths in addition to the Ramayana. For instance, in the stories of Cain and Abel, King Lear, and the TV series Succession. Entire nations, like the Jewish people, may base their identity on the claim that we are Father's favorite children. The second major plotline of the Ramayana focuses on the romantic triangle formed by Prince Rama, his lover Sita, and the demon king Ravana, who kidnaps Sita. Boy meets girl and boy fights boy over girl are also biological dramas that have been enacted by countless mammals, birds, reptiles, and fish for hundreds of millions of years. We are mesmerized by these stories because understanding them has been essential for our ancestors' survival. Human storytellers, like Homer, Shakespeare, and Valmiki, the purported author of the Ramayana, have displayed an amazing capacity to elaborate on the biological dramas. But even the greatest poetical narratives usually copy their basic plotline from the Handbook of Evolution. A third theme recurring in the Ramayana is the tension between purity and impurity, with Sita being the paragon of purity in Hindu culture. The cultural obsession with purity originates in the evolutionary struggle to avoid pollution. All animals are torn between the need to try new food and the fear of being poisoned. Evolution, therefore, equipped animals with both curiosity and the capacity to feel disgust on coming into contact with something toxic or otherwise dangerous. Politicians and prophets have learned how to manipulate these disgust mechanisms. In nationalist and religious myths, countries or churches are depicted as a biological body in danger of being polluted by impure intruders. For centuries, bigots have often said that ethnic and religious minorities spread diseases, that LGBTQ people are a source of pollution, or that women are impure. During the Rwanda genocide of 1994, Hutu propaganda referred to the Tutsis as cockroaches. The Nazis compared Jews to rats. Experiments have shown that chimpanzees, too, react with disgust to images of unfamiliar chimpanzees from another band. Perhaps in no other culture was the biological drama of purity versus impurity carried to greater extremes than in traditional Hinduism. It constructed an intersubjective system of castes ranked by their supposed level of purity, with the pure Brahmins at the top, and the allegedly impure Dalit, formerly known as untouchables, at the bottom. Professions, tools, and everyday activities have also been classified by their level of purity, and strict rules have forbidden impure persons to marry pure people, touch them, prepare food for them, or even come near them. The modern state of India still struggles with this legacy, which influences almost all aspects of life. For example, fears of impurity created various complications for the aforementioned Clean India mission, because allegedly pure people were reluctant to get involved in impure activities such as building, maintaining, and cleaning toilets, or to share public latrines with allegedly impure persons. On September 25, 2019, two Dalit children, 12-year-old Roshni Valmiki and her 10-year-old nephew, Avinash, were lynched in the Indian village of Bhagadi for defecating near the house of a family from the higher Yadav caste. They were forced to defecate in public because their houses lacked functioning toilets. A local official later explained that their household, while being among the poorest in the village, was nevertheless excluded from the list of families eligible for government aid to build toilets. The children routinely suffered from other caste-based discrimination, for example, being forced to bring separate mats and utensils to school and to sit apart from the other pupils so as not to pollute them. The list of biological dramas that press our emotional buttons includes several additional classics, such as Who Will Be Alpha, Us Versus Them, and Good Versus Evil. These dramas, too, feature prominently in the Ramayana, and all of them are well known to wolf packs and chimpanzee bands, as well as to human societies. Together, these biological dramas form the backbone of almost all human art and mythology. But art's dependence on the biological dramas has made it difficult for artists to explain the mechanisms of bureaucracy. The Ramayana is set within the context of large agrarian kingdoms, but it shows little interest in how such kingdoms register property, collect taxes, catalogue archives, or finance wars. Sibling rivalry and romantic triangles aren't a good guide for the dynamics of documents, which have no siblings and no romantic life. Storytellers like Franz Kafka, who focused on the often surreal ways that bureaucracy shapes human lives, pioneered new non-biological plot lines. In Kafka's The Trial, the bank clerk K is arrested by unidentified officials of an unfathomable agency for an unnamed crime. Despite his best efforts, he never understands what is happening to him or uncovers the aims of the agency that is crushing him. While sometimes taken as an existential or theological reference to the human condition in the universe and to the unfathomability of God, on a more mundane level, the story highlights the potentially nightmarish character of bureaucracies, which, as an insurance lawyer, Kafka knew all too well. In bureaucratic societies, the lives of ordinary people are often upended by unidentified officials of an unfathomable agency for incomprehensible reasons. Whereas stories about heroes who confront monsters, from the Ramayana to Spider-Man, repackage the biological dramas of confronting predators and romantic rivals, the unique horror of Kafkaesque stories comes from the unfathomability of the threat. Evolution has primed our minds to understand death by a tiger. Our mind finds it much more difficult to understand death by a document. Some portrayals of bureaucracy are satirical. Joseph Heller's iconic 1961 novel, Catch-22, used satire to illustrate the central role bureaucracy plays in war. One of the most powerful figures in the novel is ex-private First Class Wintergreen, who, from his power base in the mailroom, decides which letters to forward and which to disappear. The 1980s British sitcoms Yes Minister and Yes Prime Minister showed the ways that civil servants use arcane regulations, obscure subcommittees, and piles of documents to manipulate their political bosses. The 2015 comedy drama, The Big Short, explored the bureaucratic roots of the 2007-08 financial crisis. The movie's arch-villains are not humans, but collateralized debt obligations, CDOs, which are financial devices invented by investment bankers and understood by nobody else in the world. These bureaucratic Godzillas slumbered unnoticed in the depths of bank portfolios, until they suddenly emerged in 2007 to wreak havoc on the lives of billions of people by instigating a major financial crisis. Artworks like these have had some success in shaping perceptions of how bureaucratic power works, but this is an uphill battle, because since the Stone Age, our minds have been primed to focus on biological dramas rather than bureaucratic ones. Most Hollywood and Bollywood blockbusters are not about CDOs. Rather, even in the 21st century, most blockbusters are essentially Stone Age stories about the hero who fights the monster to win the girl. Similarly, when depicting the dynamics of political power, TV series like Game of Thrones, The Crown, and Succession focus on the family intrigues of the dynastic court rather than on the bureaucratic labyrinth that sustains, and sometimes curbs, the dynasty's power. Let's kill all the lawyers. The difficulty of depicting and understanding bureaucratic realities has had unfortunate results. On the one hand, it leaves people feeling helpless in the face of harmful powers they do not understand, like the hero of The Trial. On the other hand, it also leaves people with the impression that bureaucracy is a malign conspiracy, even in cases when it is in fact a benign force, providing us with healthcare, security, and justice. In the 16th century, Ludovico Ariosto described the allegorical figure of discord as a woman who walks around in a cloud of sheaves of summonses and writs, cross-examinations and powers of attorney, and great piles of glosses, counsel's opinions, and precedents, all of which tended to the greater insecurity of impoverished folk. In front and behind her and on either side, she was hemmed in by notaries, attorneys, and barristers. In his description of Jack Cade's Rebellion, 1450, in Henry VI, Part 2, Shakespeare has a commoner rebel called Dick the Butcher take the antipathy to bureaucracy to its logical conclusion. Dick has a plan to establish a better social order. "The first thing we do," advises Dick, "let's kill all the lawyers." The rebel leader, Jack Cade, runs with Dick's proposal in a forceful attack on bureaucracy, and in particular on written documents. "Is not this a lamentable thing? That of the skin of an innocent lamb should be made parchment? That parchment, being scribbled o'er, should undo a man? Some say the bee stings, but I say, 'tis the bee's wax. For I did but seal once to a thing, and I was never mine own man since." Just then the rebels capture a clerk and accuse him of being able to write and read. After a short interrogation that establishes his crime, Cade orders his men, "hang him with his pen and inkhorn about his neck." 70 years prior to Jack Cade's rebellion, during the even bigger 1381 Peasants' Revolt, the rebels focused their ire not only on flesh and blood bureaucrats, but also on their documents, destroying numerous archives and burning court rolls, charters, and administrative and legal records. In one incident, they made a bonfire of the archives of the University of Cambridge. An old woman named Marjorie Starr scattered the ashes to the winds while crying, "Away with the learning of the clerks! Away with it!" Thomas Walsingham, a monk in St. Albans Abbey who witnessed the destruction of the abbey's archive firsthand, described how the rebels set fire to all court rolls and muniments, so that after they had got rid of these records of their ancient service, their lords would not be able to claim any right at all against them at some future time. Killing the documents erased the debts. Similar attacks on archives characterized numerous other insurgencies throughout history. For example, during the Great Jewish Revolt in 66 CE, one of the first things the rebels did upon capturing Jerusalem was to set fire to the central archive in order to destroy records of debts, thereby winning the support of the populace. During the French Revolution in 1789, numerous local and regional archives were destroyed for comparable reasons. Many rebels might have been illiterate, but they knew that without the documents, the bureaucratic machine couldn't function. I can sympathize with the suspicion of government bureaucracies and of the power of official documents, because they have played an important role in my own family. My maternal grandfather had his life upended by a government census and by the inability to find a crucial document. My grandfather, Bruno Luttinger, was born in 1913 in Chernivtsi. Today this town is in Ukraine, but in 1913 it was part of the Habsburg Empire. Bruno's father disappeared in World War I, and he was raised by his mother, Chaya Pearl. When the war was over, Chernivtsi was annexed to Romania. In the late 1930s, as Romania became a fascist dictatorship, an important plank of its new anti-Semitic policy was to conduct a Jewish census. In 1936, official statistics said that 758,000 Jews lived in Romania, constituting 4.2% of the population. The same official statistics said that the total number of refugees from the USSR, Jews and non-Jews, was about 11,000. In 1937, a new fascist government came to power, headed by Prime Minister Octavian Goga. Goga was a renowned poet as well as a politician, but he quickly graduated from patriotic poetry to fake statistics and oppressive bureaucracy. He and his colleagues ignored the official statistics and claimed that hundreds of thousands of Jewish refugees were flooding into Romania. In several interviews, Goga claimed that 500,000 Jews had entered Romania illegally, and that the total number of Jews in the country was 1.5 million. Government organs, far-right statisticians, and popular newspapers regularly cited even higher figures. The Romanian embassy in Paris, for example, claimed that there were 1 million Jewish refugees in Romania. Christian Romanians were gripped by mass hysteria that they would soon be replaced or become a minority in a Jewish-led country. Goga's government stepped in to offer a solution to the imaginary problem invented by its own propaganda. On January 22, 1938, the government issued a law ordering all Jews in Romania to provide documented proof that they were born in Romanian territory and were entitled to Romanian citizenship. Jews who failed to provide proof would lose their citizenship, along with all rights to residence and employment. Suddenly, Romania's Jews found themselves in a bureaucratic hell. Many had to travel to their birthplace to look for the relevant documents, only to discover that the municipal archives were destroyed during World War I. Jews born in territories annexed to Romania only after 1918, like Chernivtsi, faced special difficulties because they lacked Romanian birth certificates and because many other documents about their families were archived in the former Habsburg capitals of Vienna and Budapest instead of in Bucharest. Jews often didn't even know which documents they were supposed to be looking for because the census law didn't specify which documents were considered sufficient proof. Clerks and archivists gained a new and lucrative source of income as frantic Jews offered to pay large bribes to get their hands on the right document. Even if no bribes were involved, the process was extremely costly. Any request for documentation, as well as filing the citizenship request with the authorities, involved paying fees. Finding and filing the right document did not guarantee success. A difference of a single letter between how a name was spelled on the birth certificate and on the citizenship papers was enough for the authorities to revoke the citizenship. Many Jews could not clear these bureaucratic hurdles and didn't even file a citizenship request. Of those who did, only 63% got their citizenship approved. Altogether, out of 758,000 Romanian Jews, 367,000 lost their citizenship. My grandfather, Bruno, was among them. When the new census law was passed in Bucharest, Bruno did not think much about it. He was born in Chernivtsi and had lived there all his life. The thought that he needed to prove to some bureaucrat that he was not an alien struck him as ridiculous. Moreover, in early 1938, his mother fell ill and died, and Bruno felt he had much bigger things to worry about than chasing documents. In December 1938, an official letter arrived from Bucharest cancelling Bruno's citizenship, and as an alien, he was promptly fired from his job in a Chernivtsi radio shop. Bruno was now not only alone and jobless, but also stateless and without much prospect for alternative employment. 9 months later, World War II erupted, and the danger for paperless Jews was mounting. Of the Romanian Jews who lost their citizenship in 1938, the vast majority would be murdered over the next few years by the Romanian fascists and their Nazi allies. Jews who retained their citizenship had a much higher survival rate. My grandfather repeatedly tried to escape the tightening noose, but it was difficult without the right papers. Several times he smuggled himself onto trains and ships, only to be caught and arrested. In 1940, he finally managed to board one of the last ships bound for Palestine before the gates of hell slammed shut. When he arrived in Palestine, he was immediately imprisoned by the British as an illegal immigrant. After 2 months in prison, he was offered a deal: stay in jail and risk deportation, or enlist in the British Army and get Palestinian citizenship. My grandfather grabbed the offer with both hands, and from 1941 to 1945, served in the British Army in the North African and Italian campaigns. In exchange, he got his papers. In our family, it became a sacred duty to preserve documents. Bank statements, electricity bills, expired student cards, letters from the municipality, if it had an official-looking stamp on it, it would be filed in one of the many folders in our cupboard. You never know which of these documents might one day save your life. The miracle document. Should we love the bureaucratic information network or hate it? Stories like that of my grandfather indicate the dangers inherent in bureaucratic power. Stories like that of the London cholera epidemic indicate its potential benevolence. All powerful information networks can do both good and ill, depending on how they are designed and used. Merely increasing the quantity of information in the network doesn't guarantee its benevolence, or make it any easier to find the right balance between truth and order. That is a key historical lesson for the designers and users of the new information networks of the 21st century. Future information networks, particularly those based on AI, will be different from previous networks in many ways. While in part one, we are examining how mythology and bureaucracy have been essential for large-scale information networks, in part two, we will see how AI is taking up the role of both bureaucrats and mythmakers. AI systems know how to find and process data better than flesh-and-blood bureaucrats, and AI is also acquiring the ability to compose stories better than most humans. But before we explore the new AI-based information networks of the 21st century, and before we examine the threats and promises of AI mythmakers and AI bureaucrats, there is one more thing we need to understand about the long-term history of information networks. We have now seen that information networks don't maximize truth, but rather seek to find a balance between truth and order. Bureaucracy and mythology are both essential for maintaining order, and both are happy to sacrifice truth for the sake of order. What mechanisms, then, ensure that bureaucracy and mythology don't lose touch with truth altogether? And what mechanisms enable information networks to identify and correct their own mistakes, even at the price of some disorder? The way human information networks have dealt with the problem of errors will be the main subject of the next two chapters. We'll start by considering the invention of another information technology, the Holy Book. Holy books like the Bible and the Quran are an information technology that is meant to both include all the vital information society needs and be free from all possibility of error. What happens when an information network believes itself to be utterly incapable of any error? The history of allegedly infallible holy books highlights some of the limitations of all information networks, and holds important lessons for the attempt to create infallible AIs in the 21st century. Chapter 4. Errors. The Fantasy of Infallibility. As Saint Augustine famously said, "To err is human. To persist in error is diabolical." The fallibility of human beings and the need to correct human errors have played key roles in every mythology. According to Christian mythology, the whole of history is an attempt to correct Adam and Eve's original sin. According to Marxist-Leninist thinking, even the working class is likely to be fooled by its oppressors and misidentify its own interests, which is why it requires the leadership of a wise party vanguard. Bureaucracy, too, is constantly on the lookout for errors, from misplaced documents to inefficient procedures. Complex bureaucratic systems usually contain self-disciplinary bodies, and when a major catastrophe occurs, like a military defeat or a financial meltdown, commissions of inquiry are set up to understand what went wrong and make sure that the mistake is not repeated. In order to function, self-correcting mechanisms need legitimacy. If humans are prone to error, how can we trust the self-correcting mechanisms to be free from error? To escape this seemingly endless loop, humans have often fantasized about some superhuman mechanism, free from all error, that they can rely upon to identify and correct their own mistakes. Today, one might hope that AI could provide such a mechanism, as when in April 2023, Elon Musk announced, "I am going to start something which I call TruthGPT, or a maximum truth-seeking AI that tries to understand the nature of the universe." We will see in later chapters why this is a dangerous fantasy. In previous eras, such fantasies took a different form. Religion. In our personal lives, religion can fulfill many different functions, like providing solace or explaining the mysteries of life. But historically, the most important function of religion has been to provide superhuman legitimacy for the social order. Religions like Judaism, Christianity, Islam, and Hinduism propose that their ideas and rules were established by an infallible superhuman authority and are therefore free from all possibility of error and should never be questioned or changed by fallible humans. Taking humans out of the loop. At the heart of every religion lies the fantasy of connecting to a superhuman and infallible intelligence. This is why, as we shall explore in Chapter 8, studying the history of religion is highly relevant to present-day debates about AI. In the history of religion, a recurrent problem is how to convince people that a certain dogma indeed originated from an infallible superhuman source. Even if, in principle, I am eager to submit to the gods' will, how do I know what the gods really want? Throughout history, Many humans have claimed to convey messages from the gods, but the messages often contradict one another. One person said a god appeared to her in a dream. Another person said she was visited by an angel. A third recounted how he met a spirit in the forest, and each preached a different message. The anthropologist Harvey Whitehouse recounts how when he was doing fieldwork among the Bining people of New Britain in the late 1980s, a young man called Tanotka fell sick, and in his feverish delirium began making cryptic statements like, "I am Wutka," and "I am a post." Most of these statements were heard only by Tanotka's older brother, Baninge, who began telling about them to other people and interpreting them in a creative way. Baninge said that his brother was possessed by an ancestral spirit called Wutka, and that he was divinely chosen to be the main support of the community, just as local houses were supported by a central post. After Tanotka recovered, he continued to deliver cryptic messages from Wutka, which were interpreted by Baninge in ever more elaborate ways. Baninge also began having dreams of his own, which allegedly revealed additional divine messages. He claimed that the end of the world was imminent and convinced many of the locals to grant him dictatorial powers so that he could prepare the community for the coming apocalypse. Baninge proceeded to waste almost all the community's resources on extravagant feasts and rituals. When the apocalypse didn't materialize and the community almost starved, Baninge's power collapsed. Though some locals continued to believe that he and Tanotka were divine messengers, many others concluded that the two were charlatans, or perhaps the servants of the devil. How could people distinguish the true will of the gods from the inventions or imaginations of fallible humans? Unless you had a personal divine revelation, knowing what the gods said meant trusting what fallible humans like Tanotka and Baninge claimed the gods said. But how could you trust these humans, especially if you didn't know them personally? Religion wanted to take fallible humans out of the loop and give people access to infallible superhuman laws. But religion repeatedly boiled down to trusting this or that human. One way around this problem was to create religious institutions that vetted the purported divine messengers. Already in tribal societies, communication with superhuman entities like tribal spirits was often the domain of religious experts. Among the Bining people, specialized spirit mediums known as Agungaraga were traditionally responsible for communicating with the spirits and thereby learning the hidden causes of misfortunes ranging from illness to crop failure. Their membership in an established institution made the Agungaraga more trustworthy than Tanotka and Baninge, and made their authority more stable and widely acknowledged. Among the Kalapalo tribe of Brazil, religious rituals were organized by hereditary ritual officers known as the Anetao. In ancient Celtic and Hindu societies, similar duties were the preserve of druids and Brahmins. As human societies grew and became more complex, so did their religious institutions. Priests and oracles had to train long and hard for the important task of representing the gods, so people no longer needed to trust just any lay person who claimed to have met an angel or to carry a divine message. In ancient Greece, for example, if you wanted to know what the god said, you went to an accredited expert like the Pythia, the high priestess at the Temple of Apollo in Delphi. But as long as religious institutions like oracular temples were staffed by fallible humans, they too were open to error and corruption. Herodotus recounts that when Athens was ruled by the tyrant Hippias, the pro-democracy faction bribed the Pythia to help them. Whenever any Spartan came to the Pythia to consult the gods on either official or private matters, the Pythia invariably replied that the Spartans must first free Athens from the tyrant. The Spartans, who were Hippias's allies, eventually submitted to the alleged will of the gods and sent an army to Athens that deposed Hippias in 510 BCE, leading to the establishment of Athenian democracy. If a human prophet could falsify the words of a god, then the key problem of religion wasn't solved by creating religious institutions like temples and priestly orders. People still needed to trust fallible humans in order to access the supposedly infallible gods. Was it possible to somehow bypass the humans altogether? The infallible technology. Holy books, like the Bible and the Quran, are a technology to bypass human fallibility. And religions of the book, like Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, have been built around that technological artifact. To appreciate how this technology is meant to work, we should begin by explaining what a book is and what makes books different from other kinds of written texts. A book is a fixed block of texts, such as chapters, stories, recipes, or epistles, that always go together and have many identical copies. This makes a book something different from oral tales, from bureaucratic documents, and from archives. When telling a story orally, we might tell it a little differently each time, and if many people tell the story over a long time, significant variations are bound to creep in. In contrast, all copies of a book are supposed to be identical. As for bureaucratic documents, they tend to be relatively short and often exist only as a single copy in one archive. If a long document has many copies placed in numerous archives, we would normally call it a book. Finally, a book that contains many texts is also different from an archive, because each archive contains a different collection of texts, whereas all copies of a book contain the same chapters, the same stories, or the same recipes. The book thereby ensures that many people in many times and places can access the same database. The book became an important religious technology in the first millennium BCE. After tens of thousands of years in which gods spoke to humans via shamans, priests, prophets, oracles, and other human messengers, religious movements like Judaism began arguing that the gods speak through this novel technology of the book. There is one specific book whose many chapters allegedly contain all the divine words about everything from the creation of the universe to food regulations. Crucially, no priest, prophet, or human institution can forget or change these divine words, because you can always compare what the fallible humans are telling you with what the infallible book records. But religions of the book have their own set of problems. Most obviously, who decides what to include in the holy book? The first copy didn't come down from heaven. It had to be compiled by humans. Still, the faithful hoped that this thorny problem could be solved by a once-and-for-all supreme effort. If we could get together the wisest and most trustworthy humans, and they could all agree on the contents of the holy book, from that moment onward, we could excise humans from the loop, and the divine words would forever be safe from human interference. Many objections can be raised against this procedure. Who selects the wisest humans? On the basis of what criteria? What if they cannot reach a consensus? What if they later change their minds? Nevertheless, this was the procedure used to compile holy books like the Hebrew Bible. The making of the Hebrew Bible. During the first millennium BCE, Jewish prophets, priests, and scholars produced an extensive collection of stories, documents, prophecies, poems, prayers, and chronicles. The Bible, as a single holy book, didn't exist in biblical times. King David and the prophet Isaiah never saw a copy of the Bible. It is sometimes claimed, erroneously, that the oldest surviving copy of the Bible comes from the Dead Sea Scrolls. These scrolls are a collection of about 900 different documents, written mostly in the last 2 centuries BCE and found in various caves around Qumran, a village near the Dead Sea. Most scholars believe they constituted the archive of a Jewish sect that lived nearby. Significantly, none of the scrolls contains a copy of the Bible, and no scroll indicates that the 24 books of the Old Testament were considered a single and complete database. Some of the scrolls certainly record texts that are today part of the canonical Bible. For example, 19 scrolls and fragmentary manuscripts preserve parts of the book of Genesis. But many scrolls record texts that were later excluded from the Bible. For example, more than 20 scrolls and fragments preserve parts of the Book of Enoch, a book allegedly written by the patriarch Enoch, the great-grandfather of Noah, and containing the history of the angels and demons, as well as a prophecy about the coming of the Messiah. The Jews of Qumran apparently gave great importance to both Genesis and Enoch, and did not think that Genesis was canonical while Enoch was apocryphal. Indeed, to this day, some Ethiopian Jewish and Christian sects consider Enoch part of their canon. Even the scrolls that record future canonical texts sometimes differ from the present-day canonical version. For example, the canonical text of Deuteronomy 32:8 says that God divided the nations of the earth according to the number of the sons of Israel. The version recorded in the Dead Sea Scrolls has the number of the sons of God instead, implying a rather startling notion that God has multiple sons. In Deuteronomy 8:6, the canonical text requires the faithful to fear God, whereas the Dead Sea version asks them to love God. Some variations are much more substantial than just a single word here or there. The Psalms scrolls contain several entire psalms that are missing from the canonical Bible, most notably Psalms 151, 154, 155. Similarly, the oldest translation of the Bible, the Greek Septuagint, completed between the 3rd and the 1st centuries BCE, is different in many ways from the later canonical version. It includes, for example, the books of Tobit, Judith, Sirach, Maccabees, the Wisdom of Solomon, the Psalms of Solomon, and Psalm 151. It also has longer versions of Daniel and Esther. Its book of Jeremiah is 15% shorter than the canonical version. Finally, in Deuteronomy 32:8, most Septuagint manuscripts have either sons of God or angels of God, rather than sons of Israel. It took centuries of hair-splitting debates among learned Jewish sages, known as rabbis, to streamline the canonical database and to decide which of the many texts in circulation would get into the Bible as the official word of Jehovah and which would be excluded. By the time of Jesus, agreement was probably reached on most of the texts, but even a century later, rabbis were still arguing whether the Song of Songs should be part of the canon or not. Some rabbis condemned that text as secular love poetry, while Rabbi Akiva, died 135 CE, defended it as the divinely inspired creation of King Solomon. Akiva famously said that the Song of Songs is the Holy of Holies. By the end of the 2nd century CE, widespread consensus was apparently reached among Jewish rabbis about which texts were part of the biblical canon and which were not. But debates about this matter, and about the precise wordings, spelling, and pronunciation of each text, were not finally resolved until the Masoretic era, 7th to 10th centuries CE. This process of canonization decided that Genesis was the word of Jehovah, but the Book of Enoch, the life of Adam and Eve, and the Testament of Abraham were human fabrications. The Psalms of King David were canonized, minus Psalms 151 to 55, but the Psalms of King Solomon were not. The Book of Malachi got the seal of approval. The Book of Baruch did not. Chronicles, yes. Maccabees, no. Interestingly, some books mentioned in the Bible itself failed to get into the canon. For example, the books of Joshua and Samuel both refer to a very ancient sacred text known as the Book of Jasher, Joshua 10:13, 2 Samuel 1:18. The Book of Numbers refers to the Book of the Wars of the Lord, Numbers 21:14. And when 2 Chronicles surveys the reign of King Solomon, it concludes by saying that the rests of the Acts of Solomon, first and last, are written in the Chronicles of Nathan the prophet, and in the prophecy of Ahijah the Shilonite, and in the visions of Iddo the seer. 2 Chronicles 9:29. The books of Iddo, Ahijah and Nathan, as well as the books of Jasher and the Wars of the Lord, aren't in the canonical Bible. Apparently, they were not excluded on purpose, they just got lost. After the canon was sealed, most Jews gradually forgot the role of human institutions in the messy process of compiling the Bible. Jewish orthodoxy maintained that God personally handed down to Moses at Mount Sinai the entire first part of the Bible, the Torah. Many rabbis further argued that God created the Torah at the very dawn of time, so that even biblical characters who lived before Moses, like Noah and Adam, read and studied it. The other parts of the Bible also came to be seen as a divinely created or divinely inspired text, totally different from ordinary human compilations. Once the Holy Book was sealed, it was hoped that Jews now had direct access to Jehovah's exact words, which no fallible human or corrupt institution could erase or alter. Anticipating the blockchain idea by 2,000 years, Jews began making numerous copies of the Holy Code, and every Jewish community was supposed to have at least one in its synagogue or its Beit Midrash, house of study. This was meant to achieve two things. First, disseminating many copies of the Holy Book promised to democratize religion and place strict limits on the power of would-be human autocrats. Whereas the archives of Egyptian pharaohs and Assyrian kings empowered the unfathomable kingly bureaucracy at the expense of the masses, the Jewish Holy Book seemed to give power to the masses, who could now hold even the most brazen leader accountable to God's laws. Second, and more important, having numerous copies of the same book prevented any meddling with the text. If there were thousands of identical copies in numerous locations, any attempt to change even a single letter in the Holy Code could easily be exposed as a fraud. With numerous Bibles available in far-flung locations, Jews replaced human despotism with divine sovereignty. The social order was now guaranteed by the infallible technology of the book. Or so it seemed. The Institution Strikes Back. Even before the process of canonizing the Bible was completed, the biblical project had run into further difficulties. Agreeing on the precise contents of the Holy Book was not the only problem with this supposedly infallible technology. Another obvious problem concerned copying the text. For the Holy Book to work its magic, Jews needed to have many copies wherever they lived. With Jewish centers emerging not only in Palestine but also in Mesopotamia and Egypt, and with new Jewish communities extending from Central Asia to the Atlantic, how to make sure that copyists working thousands of kilometers apart would not change the Holy Book either on purpose or by mistake? To forestall such problems, the rabbis who canonized the Bible devised painstaking regulations for copying the Holy Book. For example, a scribe was not allowed to pause at certain critical moments in the copying process. When writing the name of God, the scribe may not respond even if the king greets him. If he was about to write two or three divine names successively, he may pause between them and respond. Rabbi Yishmael 2nd century CE, told one copyist, "You are doing heaven's work, and if you delete one letter or add one letter, you destroy the entire world." In truth, copying errors crept in without destroying the entire world, and no two ancient Bibles were identical. A second and much bigger problem concerned interpretation. Even when people agree on the sanctity of a book and on its exact wording, they can still interpret the same words in different ways. The Bible says that you should not work on the Sabbath, but it doesn't clarify what counts as work. Is it okay to water your field on the Sabbath? What about watering your flower pot or herd of goats? Is it okay to read a book on the Sabbath? How about writing a book? How about tearing a piece of paper? The rabbis ruled that reading a book isn't work, but tearing paper is work, which is why nowadays Orthodox Jews prepare a stack of already ripped toilet paper to use on the Sabbath. The Holy Book also says that you should not cook a young goat in its mother's milk, Exodus 23:19. Some people interpreted this quite literally. If you slaughter a young goat, don't cook it in the milk of its own mother. But it's fine to cook it in the milk of an unrelated goat or in the milk of a cow. Other people interpreted this prohibition much more broadly to mean that meat and dairy products should never be mixed, so you are not allowed to have a milkshake after fried chicken. As unlikely as this may sound, most rabbis ruled that the second interpretation is the correct one, even though chickens don't lactate. More problems resulted from the fact that even if the technology of the book succeeded in limiting changes to the holy words, the world beyond the book continued to spin, and it was unclear how to relate old rules to new situations. Most biblical texts focused on the lives of Jewish shepherds and farmers in the hill country of Palestine and in the sacred city of Jerusalem. But by the 2nd century CE, most Jews lived elsewhere. A particularly large Jewish community grew in the port of Alexandria, one of the richest metropolises of the Roman Empire. A Jewish shipping magnate living in Alexandria would have found that many of the biblical laws were irrelevant to his life, while many of his pressing questions had no clear answers in the holy text. He couldn't obey the commandments about worshipping in the Jerusalem temple, because not only did he not live near Jerusalem, but the temple didn't even exist anymore. In contrast, when he contemplated whether it was kosher for him to sail his Rome-bound grain ships on the Sabbath, it turned out that long sea voyages were not considered by the authors of Leviticus and Deuteronomy. Inevitably, the holy book spawned numerous interpretations, which were far more consequential than the book itself. As Jews increasingly argued over the interpretation of the Bible, rabbis gained more power and prestige. Writing down the word of Jehovah was supposed to limit the authority of the old priestly institution, but it gave rise to the authority of a new rabbinical institution. Rabbis became the Jewish technocratic elite, developing their rational and rhetorical skills through years of philosophical debates and legal disputations. The attempt to bypass fallible human institutions by relying on a new information technology backfired because of the need for a human institution to interpret the Holy Book. When the rabbis eventually reached some consensus about how to interpret the Bible, Jews saw another chance to get rid of the fallible human institution. They imagined that if they wrote the agreed interpretation in a new holy book and made numerous copies of it, that would eliminate the need for any further human intercession between them and the divine code. So, after much back and forth about which rabbinical opinions should be included and which should be ignored, a new holy book was canonized in the 3rd century CE, the Mishnah. As the Mishnah became more authoritative than the plain text of the Bible, Jews began to believe that the Mishnah could not possibly have been created by humans. It too must have been inspired by Jehovah, or perhaps even composed by the infallible deity in person. Today, many Orthodox Jews firmly believe that the Mishnah was handed to Moses by Jehovah on Mount Sinai, passed orally from generation to generation, until it was written down in the 3rd century CE. Alas, no sooner had the Mishnah been canonized and copied than Jews began arguing about the correct interpretation of the Mishnah. And when a consensus was reached about the interpretation of the Mishnah and canonized in the 5th to 6th centuries as a third holy book, the Talmud, Jews began disagreeing about the interpretation of the Talmud. The dream of bypassing fallible human institutions through the technology of the holy book never materialized. With each iteration, the power of the rabbinical institution only increased. Trust the infallible book turned into trust the humans who interpret the book. Judaism was shaped by the Talmud far more than by the Bible, and rabbinical arguments about the interpretation of the Talmud became even more important than the Talmud itself. This is inevitable, because the world keeps changing. The Mishnah and Talmud dealt with questions raised by 2nd century Jewish shipping magnates that had no clear answers in the Bible. Modernity, too, raised many new questions that have no straightforward answers in the Mishnah and Talmud. For example, when electrical appliances developed in the 20th century, Jews struggled with numerous unprecedented questions, such as whether it is okay to press the electrical buttons of an elevator on the Sabbath. The Orthodox answer is no. As noted earlier, the Bible forbids working on the Sabbath, and rabbis argued that pressing an electrical button is work because electricity is akin to fire, and it has long been established that kindling a fire is work. Does this mean that elderly Jews living in the Brooklyn high-rise must climb 100 steps to their apartment in order to avoid working on the Sabbath? Well, Orthodox Jews invented a Sabbath elevator, which continually goes up and down buildings, stopping on every floor, without you having to perform any work by pressing an electrical button. The invention of AI gives another twist to this old story. By relying on facial recognition, an AI can quickly direct the elevator to your floor without making you desecrate the Sabbath. This profusion of texts and interpretations has, over time, caused a profound change in Judaism. Originally, it was a religion of priests and temples focused on rituals and sacrifices. In biblical times, the quintessential Jewish scene was a priest in blood-splattered robes sacrificing a lamb on the altar of Jehovah. Over the centuries, however, Judaism became an information religion, obsessed with texts and interpretations. From 2nd century Alexandria to 21st century Brooklyn, the quintessential Jewish scene became a group of rabbis arguing about the interpretation of a text. This change was extremely surprising, given that almost nowhere in the Bible itself do you find anyone arguing about the interpretation of any text. Such debates were not part of biblical culture itself. For example, when Korah and his followers challenged the right of Moses to lead the people of Israel and demanded a more equitable division of power, Moses reacted not by entering a learned discussion or by quoting some scriptural passage. Rather, Moses called upon God to perform a miracle, and the moment he finished speaking, the ground split, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them and their households. Numbers 16:31-32. When Elijah was challenged by 450 prophets of Baal and 400 prophets of Asherah to a public test in front of the people of Israel, he proved the superiority of Jehovah over Baal and Asherah first by miraculously summoning fire from the sky and then by slaughtering the pagan prophets. Nobody read any text and nobody engaged in any rational debate. 1 Kings 18. As Judaism replaced sacrifices with texts, It gravitated toward a view of information as the most fundamental building block of reality, anticipating current ideas in physics and computer science. The flood of texts generated by rabbis was increasingly seen as more important and even more real than plowing a field, baking a loaf of bread, or sacrificing a lamb in a temple. After the temple in Jerusalem was destroyed by the Romans and all temple rituals ceased, rabbis nevertheless devoted enormous efforts to writing texts about the proper way to conduct temple rituals and then arguing about the correct interpretation of these texts. Centuries after the temple was no more, the amount of information concerning these virtual rituals only continued to increase. The rabbis weren't oblivious to this seeming gap between text and reality. Rather, they maintained that writing texts about the rituals and arguing about these texts were far more important than actually performing the rituals. This eventually led the rabbis to believe that the entire universe was an information sphere, a realm composed of words and running on the alphabetical code of the Hebrew letters. They further maintained that this informational universe was created so that Jews could read texts and argue about their interpretation, and that if Jews ever stop reading these texts and arguing about them, the universe will cease to exist. In everyday life, this view meant that for the rabbis, words in texts were often more important than facts in the world. Or, more accurately, which words appeared in sacred texts became some of the most important facts about the world, shaping the lives of individuals and entire communities. The Split Bible. This description of the canonization of the Bible and the creation of the Mishnah and Talmud ignores one very important fact. The process of canonizing the Word of Jehovah created not one chain of texts, but several competing chains. There were people who believed in Jehovah, but not in the rabbis. Most of these dissenters did accept the first block in the biblical chain, which they called the Old Testament. But already before the rabbis sealed this block, the dissenters rejected the authority of the entire rabbinical institution, which led them to subsequently reject the Mishnah and Talmud too. These dissenters were the Christians. When Christianity emerged in the first century CE, it was not a unified religion, but rather a variety of Jewish movements that didn't agree on much, except that they all regarded Jesus Christ, rather than the rabbinical institution, as the ultimate authority on Jehovah's words. Christians accepted the divinity of texts like Genesis, Samuel, and Isaiah, but they argued that the rabbis misunderstood these texts, and only Jesus and his disciples knew the true meaning of passages like, "The Lord himself will give you a sign," "The Alma will conceive and give birth to a son, and will call him Emmanuel." Isaiah 7:14. The rabbis said Alma meant young woman, Emmanuel meant God with us. In Hebrew, Imanu means with us and El means God. And the entire passage was interpreted as a divine promise to help the Jewish people in their struggle against oppressive foreign empires. In contrast, the Christians argued that Alma meant virgin, that Emmanuel meant that God will literally be born among humans, and that this was a prophecy about the divine Jesus being born on earth to the Virgin Mary. However, by rejecting the rabbinical institution while simultaneously accepting the possibility of new divine revelations, the Christians opened the door to chaos. In the first century CE, and even more so in the second and third century CE, different Christians came up with radically new interpretations for books like Genesis and Isaiah, as well as with a plethora of new messages from God. Since they rejected the authority of the rabbis, since Jesus was dead and couldn't adjudicate between them, and since a unified Christian church didn't yet exist, who could decide which of all these interpretations and messages were divinely inspired? Thus, it was not just John who described the end of the world in his Apocalypse, the Book of Revelation. We have many additional apocalypses from that era, for example, the Apocalypse of Peter, the Apocalypse of James, and even the Apocalypse of Abraham. As for the life and teachings of Jesus, in addition to the four Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, early Christians had the Gospel of Peter, the Gospel of Mary, the Gospel of Truth, the Gospel of the Saviour, and numerous others. Similarly, aside from the Acts of the Apostles, there were at least a dozen other Acts, such as the Acts of Peter and the Acts of Andrew. Letters were even more prolific. Most present-day Christian Bibles contain 14 epistles attributed to Paul, 3 attributed to John, 2 to Peter, and 1 each to James and Jude. Ancient Christians were familiar not only with additional Pauline letters, such as the Epistle to the Laodiceans, but with numerous other epistles supposedly written by other disciples and saints. As Christians composed more and more Gospels, epistles, prophecies, parables, prayers, and other texts, it became harder to know which ones to pay attention to. Christians needed a curation institution. That's how the New Testament was created. At roughly the same time that debates among Jewish rabbis were producing the Mishnah and Talmud, debates among Christian priests, bishops, and theologians were producing the New Testament. In a letter from 367 CE, Bishop Athanasius of Alexandria recommended 27 texts that faithful Christians should read, a rather eclectic collection of stories, letters, and prophecies written by different people in different times and places.